Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 51 of NML Crossing, where we're about to start a couple of days in Azrael land, for better or worse. Which means that these next couple of episodes are probably going to be a little bit shorter than usual, because, well, there really isn't a whole heck of a lot to say. We'll try to, you know, make it as fun as possible, or as... I can't say entertaining or interesting, since it's going to be me delivering this information here, but we'll make the best of it. We'll do the best we can. And if you're listening in real time, today is April 1st. So April Fool's Day, and seems like this time of year is always kind of snake bit for me. Now, this year being a prime example of that, because ever since I started X-Lapsed, I wanted to do something special for April Fool's Day. Back when we were doing X-Lapsed, I had found a I found this issue of Count Duckula, where it's like Count Duckula teaming up with Geraldo Rivera. And I always wanted to talk about that issue. Me and Reggie were going to talk about that issue ages ago, because it's just so damn weird. And I was going to do a whole production where it was going to be Count Duckula-lapsed instead of X-Lapsed. And I was going to treat it completely straight, all the way through, including fake emails that I wrote to myself. Like, I took bits and pieces of some emails I got from the prolific writers in the... I don't know if I can call them letter hacks, since they're just writing into me, but folks like Damien. Damien used to write a lot in the days of X-Lapsed, and I had an email from him, and I had an email from Andrew in Belfast. I had a bunch of emails written up about Count Duckula. You know, it's going to be... I thought it was going to be pretty fun, but this time of year is just never works. And this year, I have half a script written for what was going to be the April Fool's episode. It was something I was calling Nick Scratch Fever. Had, you know, the very song you're probably thinking that I was going to use for it, all ready to go. I had half a script written, basically treating it as a... like an episode of Weird Comics History, where I was just going to cover the entire Nick Scratch experience. And just going to play it completely straight. It was probably going to be like episode 310 of the show. I thought it was going to be fun. But, hey, this year ain't great. So we're not going to do that just yet. Maybe when we're done with NML Crossing, we'll... do one of those, you know, Animal House, you know, where are they now sort of things, and we'll do a little bit of a retrospective on our man Nick Scratch. And, well, Nick Scratch is very apropos today, since we are in Azrael land, and Azrael is going to be doing some Nick Scratchy stuff. So how about we hop on in to Azrael, Agent of the Bat number 50. Hey, a milestone issue. March 1999 cover date. The story is called Resurrection, written by Denny O'Neill. Pencils, Roger Robinson. Inks, James Pasco. Colors, Demetrius Basukos and Prismacolor. Letters, Ken Bruzanak. Edits, Berrios and Carlin. Cover price, $2.25. And we open with JPV hanging out in a church where he's approached by Batman. Now, Batman needs a little bit of help, and, well... he needs John Paul to deal with Nicholas Scratch. Now, JP doesn't understand why Scratch is still on the table, so, you know, after all, he already got what he wanted, right? Gotham is cut off from the United States, so why would anybody spend any time or exert any effort worrying about Nick Scratch? Now, Batman says he's concerned that Scratch will be there to undo all of their potential accomplishments in rebuilding the city. In other words, maybe I'm reading into it, but I think he just wants to keep Azrael busy. And I'm pretty sure I would feel the same exact way. You know, keeping Azrael away from the action seems like, you know, basic risk mitigation to me. You know, if you were ever in a management level position and you have like that one employee who might not be the best at a certain thing, you keep them away from that certain thing, right? So, risk mitigation, because Azrael sucks. Batman then produces a new costume for JP to wear when he's working, since, of course, the old Azrael stuff is now associated with the murder of Senator Esty Halivan. Now, Jean-Paul, he ain't so sure about it. He says his usual suit triggers his special abilities. Batman tells him to just do the damn thing. Just stop talking and do the thing. He doesn't even give him a starting point. He's like, go find Nick Scratch. I don't care how you do it. I don't care where you go. Just find Nick Scratch somehow. And so, we jump ahead 24 hours where Jean-Paul is driving his Volkswagen while chatting up Oracle. And we get a bit of a sort of kind of exposition dump in order to catch us all up on the devil heads and whatnot. Babs is definitely flirting with our guy here. JPS for some intel on Scratch, which I know Googling wasn't really a thing back then, but the info Barbara is able to deliver is the very definition of surface-level stuff. She discovers such top-secret information as the fact that Nick Scratch once shared an office with a guy named Kurt Lade. Great. She shoots a map over to JP's laptop so he can check in with Lade. Meanwhile, Nicholas Scratch is talking with his devil heads about dun-dun-dun, Kurt Lade, which, yeah, that's awfully convenient, right? Out of nowhere, Nick Scratch wants Kurt Lade killed. Naturally. You see, Lade evidently took credit for the devil head-making process? Or something? I mean, who would want the credit for that? I mean, did they submit that to scientific journals? That they turned idiots into devil heads who were incapable of doing anything? I don't know. I mean, was that peer-reviewed? Maybe, maybe not. Anyway, Nick also wants Batman and the clumsy angel Azrael taken out. Later on, we rejoin JP as he's entering the town of Asphodel? Asphodel? Well, I don't know what that is, but Asphodel Meadows was a section of the ancient Greek underworld where ordinary souls would live on after death. JP keeps driving, finally happening upon his destination, which is a creepy house in the middle of nowhere. He gets out and he tries to plan his next move. Now, he thinks about going in as plain old JPV, or maybe even using his new costume. But he ultimately decides to use the currently wanted for murder red and black Azrael togs. Great. Somehow, he's spotted by this creepy town's version of Paul Revere, who goes running to a tavern to announce that the weirdo who killed Halivan is there. Now, the rubes think about the potential reward they might get if they catch him and turn him in, and so they reach for their guns and head toward Lade's house. Meanwhile, Azrael is chatting up Mr. Lade, or maybe it's Dr. Lade, I don't know. Now, Lade believes that Azrael's there to kill him, just like Azrael killed Senator Halivan. Now, Azrael pleads his innocence, which is apparently good enough for Lade. He's like, okay, you said you didn't do it? That's cool. Our man then asks about Nicholas Scratch. Lade says Scratch used to be such a nice young fella till something happened to him. Azrael asks if Scratch has any family. Then we find out he does not. His parents were killed in a car accident when he was only 4 years old. Now, Azrael tells Lade to sleep on it. Sleep on what exactly? I don't know, but I guess sleep on it and he'll ask him the same question. Like, ask what? If Scratch has a family? Didn't we get the answer to that already? Okay. Anyway, just as Lade claims he remembers something, a shot rings out, narrowly missing JP's dome. And it's the yokels. Four of them. And I guess they're giving up on the reward if they're just going to kill him? I don't know. Now, Azrael immediately knows that they're there for him. Maybe that's one of the powers unlocked by this suit that he's wearing? I don't know. From here, we get several pages of fighting. Until one of the yokels appears to fall into a trance. This is an odd... It makes me feel like we're missing pages here. Azrael just tells this guy that he's holding a gun, which for some reason surprises the guy, so much so that he drops the piece, then rambles about the sunset or something before falling to the ground. And then we can see that there's a knife sticking out of his back. Probably a knife bought in Gotham City, right? Next we know, Azrael is surrounded by devil heads who just showed up. They beat the hell out of him, And conveniently, they tear up his Asriel costume. They even unmask the poor idiot, though nobody there recognizes stupid Jean-Paul Valley. They then nab Lade and, they knock his ass out, before setting the entire house on fire. We jump ahead a little bit, time passes, and Jean-Paul finally comes to, and the place is an inferno. JP is pinned down, tied up with rope around his ridiculous and massively oversized gauntlets, which further illustrates how terrible the Devilheads are at, well, pretty much anything they try. Because you see, Jean-Paul is able to free himself simply by taking off his stupid gloves. Okay. He then lunges toward Lade, snatching him up and taking him outside to safety. JPV then finds himself assaulted by pangs of conscience. He realizes that he probably ought to head back into the Flaming House to rescue the yokels who had, just a few minutes ago, tried to kill him. And so he does. Now, by the time he's done saving the goofs, Lade has fled the scene. We wrap up the issue with Jean-Paul heading over to his Volkswagen, where he finally comes to terms with the fact that if he's gonna continue vigilante-ing, he's gonna have to wear his new, ridiculously ugly headsock Asriel costume. And so, we close out our landmark 50th issue with our main man striking a cringy pose in his hilariously dated new duds. And that's where we leave it. Next time out, more of the Asriel's new clothes. And so, here we sit. And I can't help but think to myself, I wish this was the day where I forgot to talk about the issue we covered. Because, this wasn't great. It was a lot of fun to cover. It was a lot of fun to script. But there really isn't a whole heck of a lot here. I was cruising Usenet probably 3 weeks ago. 2-3 weeks ago. And I was reading all of these posts about Denny O'Neill's health. During this time, apparently, he was in a restaurant and died. He had some sort of event. He went down, and it was only due to the fact that there was a doctor in the house that he was revived. So, with that knowledge, I feel really, really bad. Even worse, saying bad things about this issue than we have thus far talking about Asriel. Because, I've had fun with it, it's all we can do. Because it's not that great, but I feel, and I always feel bad talking about, the legends in the industry who might be a little bit past their prime. And, the fact that Denny was in such poor health at the time, I just want to give him a pass on it. So, I'm going to try not to be too terribly harsh on this. We'll treat it more as... it's kind of an oddity, you know? Because the headsock costume that Asriel's going to be sporting from this point on isn't the only out-of-date thing about this book, clearly. The way the story is told, the dialogue, it all feels very, very out-of-date. And I think in a lot of situations, something like that could work as just a curiosity or as a palate cleanser. Like if you're reading all the No Man's Land stuff and you come across this issue of Asriel, it's tonally different, right? It's unique compared to the rest of the Batman line. So for that and that alone, I guess we gotta appreciate that it's a little bit different. I don't know. I'm really grasping here, aren't I? This just feels so old. Just the way everything lines up perfectly. Barbara discovers this dude Lade, and at that very moment, Nick Scratch is planning to kill him. It feels old. It doesn't feel dynamic. Asriel himself, something I didn't really include in the synopsis is that there's a lot of internal dialogue from Jean-Paul Valley here. And how do you say that? I've heard people say Jean-Paul Valley. I've heard people say Jean-Paul Valley or Valley. I don't know where to emphasize it. I just say Valley because that's the word. But there's a lot of internal monologue from him where he's really down on himself. You know, he realizes that he is ineffective as Jean-Paul. He somehow doesn't realize that he's ineffective as Asriel, but what are you going to do? I didn't include that because it was there really was no organic way to do so. I figured I would just include it here as a, you know, post-synopsis deal. Because that's something about this I actually like a lot. I feel like it's kind of just scratching the surface of being as cerebral as I think Denny's hoping it is, where we have a hero who's doubting himself constantly and whose actions and results kind of back up that doubt. They kind of reinforce it. I feel like we just scratched the surface, though. Sure, he gets his ass kicked constantly, right? It seems like every time he comes across a devil head, he gets beaten up. But it feels, I don't know, disconnected from the internal monologue. The action that we see, sure, it pays off his doubts, but it doesn't feel connected to them. I don't know if that makes any sense. I'm sure there's a better way to describe that. I just can't come up with it. Hopefully by next episode I'll be able to be a little bit more erudite, or whatever the word is here, and adequately describe what I'm trying to say, because I'm about out of words here. I don't know what else to say about the issue, unfortunately. Plus, at this point, I almost feel like I'm robbing myself of stuff to talk about next time, since we do have the follow-up to this issue in the very next episode. So I'll just leave it there. This was, it was an issue of Asriel. That's pretty much the only thing I can say about it. But I do have other things to say about other things. So how about we hop into our NML bag here for a few letters before we cut on out of here. We're going to start with our friend Chris Yu, who, this is in reply to last episode. He says, "What a wonderful surprise. Happy Easter." And I thought it was going to be fun. I didn't think anybody would listen on Easter morning. I haven't done a Sunday show in a long, long time, and I don't remember what the numbers used to be. The Cosmic Treadmill and Weird Comics History were Sunday shows back in the long ago, but I haven't done one in quite a bit, quite a while here, but it really means the world that you would listen today, Chris. He continues, "It seemed rather easy for Batman to take over Scarface's territory. Maybe Scarface was just the weakest of the gang lords, but he went down fast. I'm interested to see what hell Wesker winds up in. I don't remember there being a no man's land prison run by Batman." And that's something I don't remember either. I don't know where the ventriloquist's going to wind up, but you'd figure he's going to be taken off the streets, right? So he's got to wind up somewhere. Makes me wonder if we're going to get some follow-up on where these gang lords go after Batman disposes of them. I wonder. Maybe there'll be something with Arkham, since it's vacant right now. I really don't remember. But Scarface was, we referred to him as the level one boss last time. And I think that's probably where he ought to be. I think our level two boss we're going to be meeting in a couple of episodes. It's the Fear of Faith four-parter by Devin Grayson. And in that arc, she's using the Scarecrow. So Scarecrow might be a pretty good level two boss. We got our level one out of the way. Don't know where they might wind up after the fact. I actually, you know, for a story that we've been trying to figure out the internal logic of, I never gave that a thought, which is weird. You know, I'm trying to make this as realistic as possible while not, you know, being too far up my own ass. But I didn't even think about where these baddies were going to wind up, which is a very interesting question, and hopefully we do get an answer. Chris continues. He says, "Just like how batteries are more valuable than diamonds, the people want protection more than they want freedom. It's become a feudal society in the No Man's Land. Batman's become a gang lord, just like Jim Gordon. And their current relationship might make them enemies. And there's a lot of fun stuff in there. And like we talked about last episode, the fact that these people didn't know what to do with freedom. You know, the freedom didn't have any sort of value to them. The value was in protection, their survivability. So to be given freedom, which, I mean, it's up there, right? It's like if you could be given something, freedom is probably all anybody could ever ask for. Freedom to do whatever, freedom to be whatever, that's pretty cool, right? And here, freedom means nothing, because without protection, how long can you be free, right? How productive could that freedom be if you're constantly on the brink of death? And that's a great point about the Batman-Gordon relationship here. They are now leaders of neighborhoods, right? And everybody's trying to expand territory, so yeah, they are adversarial at best right now. And that doesn't even take into account how upset the commissioner is at Batman for disappearing. So there's a lot of meat on that bone, and I can't wait to, you know, to start getting into that. It's going to be some fun stuff. Chris wraps up with, "This opening arc just makes me want to see more." And yeah, totally. This totally lays the foundation for everything that's to come. Bob Gale did a wonderful job here just fleshing out this new world, right? We learned about the underground. We learned about the auctions. We learned about the gang lords. We learned about Oracle's chronicling. We've learned about so many things here. And we still got a story on top of it, which is really, really cool. We got new characters. We got some secret characters. It's a great arc. And going forward, when we sidestep the Azrael stuff, I think we're in for a really good time. Not to put the cart before the horse here, but Fear of Faith is a pretty good story so far. I've only scripted the first couple, but I'm really digging it, more than I thought I would. I feel like I kind of have a knee-jerk reaction to Devin Grayson from her Nightwing run, which is very unfair, because so much of what she's written I did enjoy. I really dug her time on Titans, and Gotham Knights was good, and so far, her time in No Man's Land, at least as far as I've read, has been really, really good. But we will get there when we get there. I want to thank Chris so much for taking the time to write in and for listening on Easter Sunday. Next up, we got our friend Eric, who wrote in and said, "Great to see you back. Missed hearing your podcast. I always check every morning, and luckily I did on Sunday. I just read the entire Parallax Hal Jordan issues and the Zero Hour event. I know this is an old topic, but throughout the tie-ins, Superman talks about the destruction of Metropolis. It's a background for many of the Superman issues. Superman mentions how difficult it's going to be to rebuild and have people relocated. He never mentions other heroes coming to help to rebuild, and actually mentions that there was nothing that could be done to stop the destruction of the city. However, in the Man of Steel Zero issue, Metropolis is restored, and Superman says the Zero Hour event restored the city. Just wanted to show how a similar event was handled differently, but it's another explanation of why the Justice League can't just fly in and fix everything sometimes." And that's a great point. That's a really great point. And that storyline is, I don't know if I mentioned it, but the Fall of Metropolis storyline was what was cited a lot on Usenet when No Man's Land was announced. Because I guess it was Zatanna who had magicked Metropolis back together. I think that happened during the Zero Hour stuff. But people were like, why can't Zatanna just come and undo all the damage to Gotham? And of course, I mean, internal logic speaking, of course she could do that, right? But the Fall of Metropolis stuff seems to have hit, you know, landed with a thud. You know, it wasn't, I don't think it was something that people look back fondly on, at least not the way it was all undone. I'm definitely happy to hear that you read Zero Hour, though. I love when people read Zero Hour. I always ask them a question about what they view Hal Jordan as for that story. Because clearly he's the villain, right? He's the big bad of Zero Hour. I don't see it that way. I don't see him as the villain there. And if anybody wants to discuss that, I'm definitely down to. Reggie and I did a lot of coverage on that era of Hal Jordan, and several eras of Hal Jordan, actually. And I did a lot of coverage on the blog, and I ultimately came down to the fact that Hal's not the villain, or Hal's not a villain in that story. Anyway, Eric continues. He says, as for the Chip Zdarsky Batman, I think it began really strong, and I loved having Tim Drake being the Robin for Batman. I thought Failsafe was a good creation, and I enjoyed the reuse of a lot of past Grant Morrison material. Now, thank you so much for writing in about this Zdarsky run here, because it's fresh in my mind, and I'm of a lot of thoughts on it. First, how do we say his name? Do we pronounce the D? Is it Zdarsky or is it Zdarsky? Is it the D silent? Silent. Jesus. I'm tired. Is the D silent? I say it interchangeably, but whatever the case. Yes, it started off so strong. Failsafe, the first two issues of that totally blew me away because it's such a simple concept and it was just so well done, and I can't believe it hasn't been done before, but it was really cool, really dramatic. I thought it was a great kickoff for the Zdarsky era. And it's funny, when this era was announced, I was chatting about it with my buddy Dave, and we were talking about rehashes and how these new eras and books, or when new writers come onto books, it's just doesn't feel new or novel or fresh. And despite really enjoying Zdarsky's work on Daredevil for the past little while, and he also did the X-Men Fantastic Four miniseries we covered on X-Labs, which I enjoyed a lot as well. So, despite the fact that I was pleased and kind of psyched about him starting on Batman, I'm still cynical. So I joked that, I'm like, oh, I bet he'll bring back Zurinar. And I just, as a joke, and then boom, at the end of the second issue, Zurinar's back. But the way it was done was great. I thought it was a really cool thing to do. I don't want to get too deep into it in case anybody wants to check it out. But the initial Failsafe arc was a blast. What happened afterwards, I liked the idea of it, but it took way too long. I feel like they were building to the 900th issue of Batman, the Legacy 900. And I'm on the record as complaining for every centennial issue of a superhero book. What we get instead of a story is the love letter. You know, this is the love letter to Batman. 90 pages of us gushing about Batman while not actually telling or advancing a story. This time, though, although I feel like the follow-up to Failsafe went too long, it did the near impossible in that it gave us a love letter in many different ways for Legacy 900, but it also told and advanced the story that was going on at the same time. It wasn't an anthology. It was just Chip writing his story. And it was, for that issue, it was really, really well done. I did skip the whole Gotham War stuff, so I can't really speak to that, nor do I want to. There's a lot of good stuff there if you want to check it out. If you're a little bat shy for current year stuff, you could do far worse than that Failsafe run. That was really, really cool. I got really hyped for the Joker Year One, and that. If anybody wants to talk about that one, let me know. That was not what I expected it to be. But back to Eric here. The Night Terrors and Gotham War kind of slowed down the story, but now everything seems to be back on track. And boy, I haven't thought about Night Terrors in a while. That was such a... I didn't read much of it, but it was such a poorly timed event, wasn't it? You know, we were just brand new into the Dawn of DC stuff, and then I think Titans is like supposed to be like the big book, right? It's the big team right now. And I think it went like 2 issues before being interrupted for Night Terrors. Like, that's really how we're gonna launch a whole new post-Dark Crisis on Infinite Earths landscape here, and 60 days in, you're shutting down books to put these weird miniseries out. I don't know. I definitely agree with Eric here that that would kind of slow things down. He wraps up with, you might want to read Batman the Night, because Chip Zdarsky wrote it and some of the current series refers to it. That's true. I did see a lot of editor's footnotes, which, can I just say how much I love seeing editor's footnotes again? We went years thinking that that was too comic booky, so we didn't get that. I love getting that now. I wouldn't have known about this Batman the Night miniseries because, frankly, I kind of glaze over anytime I look at the DC previews because there's just so much Batman there. There's got to be a dozen ongoings featuring just him. And so it all kind of blurs together. I just buy, Batman and Detective. I don't really veer far out of that. But I did see a lot of the footnotes for the Night. It's about Batman's mentors, the mentors that he sought knowledge and technique from. And a couple of those mentors showed up during the Joker Year One. One in a very interesting way. If for no other reason that it gives really good food for thought. And I don't want to spoil it since it is so recent, but if anyone does want to hear me talk about it on the air, I would be more than happy to do so. And I want to thank Eric so much for taking the time to write in and for chatting me up about current year stuff, as well as allowing me to go off on a zero-hour tangent. I always enjoy doing that. So thank you so much. But that's going to do it for the mail. Of course, if anybody would like to be part of the mail, I invite you to write in. You can find me all those different ways. Chris is on InfiniteEarths.com, ChrisandReggie.podbean.com, WeirdComicsHistory@gmail.com, and all the social media places as well. But that's going to do it for me for today. I would like to thank you all so much for sharing a little bit of your day with me. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight, starting over after it breaks, starting over when the story's got an astounding twist. You've ever